Hello and welcome to a brand new episode of The Lowdown. Today I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by the one and only Scott Miller. Scott, big warm welcome to the show.
Mate, good to see you. Nice to connect. Looking forward to chatting, mate.
Likewise, I know it's a while in the works and I've nearly failed on minute one with that tongue twister. But Scott, as you know, where we begin the show, could you please take us through your earliest football memory?
Oh, okay. This is what it was. Blonde hair, Scottish accent. My dad would be mowing the lawns on a Sunday afternoon, and I'd be in my Rangers kit, dying to have a kick with him in the afternoon. It would be around 5 o'clock on a Sunday, and we'd kick the ball for about 2 or 3 hours till he was finished and completely dead. And that's all I remember, running around annoying my dad on Sunday afternoon in the backyard.
Amazing. And it's again, we spoke off air just even in preparation for this podcast. I mean, we're delighted here at the Lowdown. We get so many good, really good guests in terms of so many diverse pathways into the game. But again, researching for this, I was just saying to Dave the other day, it kind of blew my mind in terms of moving from the beach in Newcastle to the lofty heights of the Premier League in England. But what a story in between. Could you please take us through what put you on that pathway of reaching that fever dream of working in Premier League football?
Wow, when you put it like that, it probably shouldn't have happened, really, because you consider where I grew up in Mount Eliza, down in Victoria, there about an hour out of Melbourne, completely dominant by cricket and AFL, the biggest game in Australia. So the exposure to soccer was small. So in terms of exposure to good coaches and experiences through that time were poor. So there was one junior club there that ignited the passion with my dad's experience in football as well. That ignited the passion and obviously moved through the ranks from that perspective. So football's been in my life for a long time, but it was, I'll tell you a funny story. It was a guy at university, I think his name was Michael, and I remember the day because I'd gone through playing representative football, state football, X, Y, and Z, and all that type of stuff. And I remember being at university second year, and we're doing this Q&A in the auditorium. And this guy put his arm up because the lecturer asked him, what are you going to do with this degree? And Michael put his arms up, who couldn't kick a ball 5 yards to hit a pass to save his life. He wasn't a footballer, right? But loved the Premier League. He put his hand up and he says, I'm going to go to the Premier League and be a fitness coach, right? And I remember at the time I was hardly paying attention because I was useless at uni. I was just get the work done, get the mark. But, the engagement was all about being social. And I heard that and I went, he's not going to the Premier League. He can't even pass a ball. He doesn't even know 4-3-3 from 3-5-2. What's he talking about, right? But, not to be cruel, but I was like, it just planted a seed. And then 2 years later, we spoke earlier. It was a case of, right, spoke to my parents and said, right, enough of this, carry on. I'm out of here. And I had a cousin in Clapham. She allowed me to stay rent-free. And then bought that ticket, mate, packed the bags and hit London and basically harassed people for about 3 or 4 months, trying to find phone numbers through switchboards and emails and all carry on. And some great people replied to me and gave me their time. And that basically set me off on the path, mate.
An absolutely unbelievable story because just in prep for the show, listening to you at a different podcast, I don't think you do it half justice in terms of, I believe when you moved over, the exchange rate was awful, wasn't it too? So you're moving over to London, have barely any contacts, just, a backpack and a bit of a plan to get into any bit of a football club. And you're just there, what is it, contacting switchboards, working four or five different multiple jobs, just batting
Yeah,
around.
it was funny. It was I had this desire that the dream wasn't going to be run down by not having enough money, right? Because what I didn't want to do was sit at home, wait for the phone call to ring. My name's not Guardiola, it's not going to ring. So I was nobody, right? I literally had one degree and a semi-professional football experience back in Australia that had no credibility in this market. So forget about it. You don't even bring that up, right? It's as simple as that. So yeah, you're right. Crazy jobs, working at Goodwood Revival, working at Queen's, Goodwood at Wimbledon, lifting crazy scaffolding and working with organizations with no OH&S and stuff. It was carnage, right? It was so funny. But I remember picking up this hot, heavy steel and lifting all this scaffolding stuff and just saying, oh, listen, I've got to make this work. This is not what I want from my life at this point. I came here with this ambition and it actually made me hungrier to push forward. And you're talking 2006. So in terms of, the old internet cafe down the high street and stuff like that, and hitting up people's email addresses and calling, the receptionist, pretending to know who's who, and then seeing if you can get through and all that, carry on. It was absolutely class. And there were a couple of times, I'll tell you, special mention to a couple of people who mean a lot to me. Martin Pert, you might know of. He's been around the trade for a long time. He actually took the phone call, and I bought him the biggest Starbucks coffee and told the girl, I said, listen, if you ever see that cup get empty, you get over here sharpish and top that up. I need to harass this guy for as long as possible and learn from him. So he'd be sick in this, the Starbucks coffee cups are here. So he's giving one of these ones and he's looking at me, go, she's filled this up again. Like, what's going on here? And I'm like, don't know, mate. Service is good. You know what I mean? So loaded him up, spent hours with Martin, and then he was a bit of a mentor for me as well over a period of time. And then probably the most, there's always one, I think, the first believer, there's always one. And mine was an Australian guy, funny enough. And he took me under his wing and gave me my first contract at Premier League level. And Steve Nance was big in the rugby game and moved into the professional game in sport. And he was the first one for me that went, come here, mate, let's go. I'm going to teach you everything. And unfortunately, left Fulham about 12 months after I started. And I thought, hey, here we go. I'm Gornski without that custodian. And sure enough, I'd proved enough in that 12 months that the key people in the club kept me on and invested in my knowledge and experience and pushed me forward. So yeah, it was good fun, mate. It's good fun now that I look back at it all.
It's pretty crazy though, right? Like you come out of uni with a sports science qualification or anything nowadays, but there's a level of problem solving skills that can't be taught and just being thrown out and there into the real world. And you mean we'll touch upon it later on with the AI piece, but is that something that you see is dwindling amongst the latest cohort of like graduates or coaches getting into today's sport?
Yeah, you know what? It's sport. You have to be so resilient, right? And we know that. And resilience means different things for different people through opportunities, through too many opportunities, and then making the right decision at any time. So, for me, whether or not it has or not, I did see that through my 10 years at Fulham in particular, and then later in my career, the acceptance of, well, I've got my degree, I should potentially, be rewarded with a job, and then ultimately wanting to work with the first team players. I mentioned this earlier, wanting to work with the first team players from day one instead of, learning their craft later on, and actually starting at academy level and then learning the ropes, because it's a cutthroat environment. And I learned this the hard way, because whether or not you call it arrogantly or self-belief, either way, I wanted to become a head coach. I came about 28, 29, and I'd spent 5, 6 years watching some pretty cool coaches, and my analytical dominant sort of mentality wanted to challenge myself. And the minute you become a head coach, your head's on the parapet, your job's on the line. So I think young graduates can take a lot for being patient and enjoying the process and enjoying the bubble you live in, and don't rush it, because one thing's for sure, being in football is one of the best jobs if you enjoy it and you're not in a hurry, because it's a privilege to be on that pitch working with players every day. It's absolutely brilliant.
That apprenticeship at Fulham that first year was something else, hey? 14, 15-hour days working with the first team in the morning, academy at night. Crazy.
It was funny. I saw it as, I don't remember even looking at my first contract before I signed it. I think they put it down and the pen was, and I signed it and threw it back to them. I didn't care about what the value was. It was basically the Willy Wonka golden ticket to walk through that receptionist, and that receptionist know your name, and you have your pass that allows you into the inner sanctum of a Premier League training ground, where you've got access to incredible high performance staff, incredible players, incredible coaching staff, incredible gym and pitches. So that access was everything. It wasn't about the salary. It was the access to just absorb everything. And you're right. I think Steve was testing me, to be fair, because he's a Queenslander from far north Queensland, hard, hard man. And yeah, be there at 7, work with the first team in the morning, under 21s in the afternoon, followed by the under 8s to 16s in the evening in the dome, for example, right? So I don't remember complaining. I just remember going, how good's this? You're working with such a broad spectrum of person. So I think that's why later in my career, moving from the sports science coaching and then psychology, I had such a breadth of people. So communication styles had to change throughout the day. You're not Brian McBride by morning, a disappointed reserve team player by 2 o'clock, and then an under eight boy trying to learn how to do a Cruyff turn and drop the shoulder, or just trying to engage that type of player in the foundation level. So that really helped my ability to understand players at totally different levels.
Amazing, and obviously going in there, beginning as a fitness coach, working right through the academy, there were some conscious first steps there in terms of planting a seed within yourself, in terms of eventually graduating onto a coaching staff, was there not?
Yeah, there really was. And I think it happened really gradually. I think that one, I was physically fit. I wasn't too long retired. Could pass a ball, could zing a ball, could control a ball, could understand the game to a certain level as well. So I think just informal conversations with players and coaches, they started to see something else. And it was really like a bit of a merge of capabilities. So it was like, when someone gives you a bit of rope, suddenly, you used to do the basic warm-ups and all the conditioning stuff and the gym stuff and the recovery and all that type of stuff. And then suddenly you get given a rondo and a passing practice. And you've been told, right, replicate our passing practice and rhythms in a game, and our movement patterns in a passing practice. And it's not just the box, follow the ball type stuff. It's so you've been given a little bit of rope and you're thinking, okay, well, they trust me a little bit more to build on that. And then suddenly it's the possession game, suddenly it's the 5v5, 7v5, small-sided games. And then the gaffer's stepping in with the tactical stuff. So you're actually gone from delivering very little to a majority of the session. And then they're actually overlaying it with their tactical stuff, which I see what is essentially what a head coach should be doing anyway. They're the knowledge bank, they're the tactical and philosophy overriders. So that's how it happened, mate. It happened over a long period of time, but just gradual, 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 gradual. What's better than receiving a ball from Berbatov or Duffer is getting zinged into you and doing some passing practices and finishing practices with players of that quality, and having autonomy to design it for them and have an impact on their performance on the weekend. Absolutely class,
What a time that was to a Fulham. And obviously, look, you're not the gaffer area, so there's an awful lot of lads probably confiding in you regarding team selection, match prep, so on and so forth. But you just mentioned about two players, Demirtaş Berbatov, Damien Duff, Clint Dempsey, Moussa Dembélé, Jimmy Bullard, all huge personalities you would have worked with throughout your time.
Yeah, for sure. And you know what? It was funny. Jimmy was actually my first case study. So Steve had to go back to Australia my first summer. So say, for example, I started at the back end of the year. He gave me Jimmy Bullard to do his rehab for his ACL in that summer. So I spent 6 weeks one-on-one with Jimmy, a young fitness coach from Australia. Didn't really know who Jimmy Bullard was. If only I knew how much about now how funny he is, I probably wouldn't have taken the job because it was 6 weeks of laughter, terror, fear, but an incredible experience just because of who he is, right? And yeah, listen, the personalities is what makes your career special, the friendships you make. But it's funny, I said to someone a while ago, he was looking for a new job, and I said, how many players have you got in your references? And he goes, oh, just the CEO and just this guy. And I said, get as many players as possible, because the reality is the impact you have is not on the CEO, it's or the COO or the CTO. It comes down to impacting players and them respecting you. So go and call 5 to 10 of your ex-players and ask if they'll be your reference, because their brands are bigger, their personal brands are bigger, their network's bigger. But more importantly, if you impacted them, they'll respect that.
It's a pretty incredible thing to say, because we'll touch upon that later on. It's really, really intriguing how you got the Australia job, and then it was referenced for Albert and Newcastle Jets later on. But throughout that time at Fulham, you were essentially irreplaceable over those 10, 11 years. If you look at a slew of Premier League greats from Hodgson, Martin Yole, the likes of Rennie Mullenstein, also Felix Magath, and several other coaches there, was there anyone in particular that had such a profound kind of, I would say, profound impact on you in terms of how you saw the game, or would have impacted your wider methodology working with first team players?
Yeah, that's a brilliant question, and and I have to go back now. It's been a few years, but I think I'll probably start at the start. Roy started to instill what coaching actually was. Coaching isn't small-sided games and possession games that don't have an outcome and don't have any patterns and movement. This is just my perspective. So his discipline around positioning, his discipline around attacking philosophy and actually improving players. Because if you think about coaching, it's not just a facilitation of fun and running around and bang, 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 bang. It's around organizing a unit to do things collectively with and without the ball. And he was a master at that. The ability to orchestrate patterns and movements, A, B, C, D, E, F. And then when the ball's here, this is how we react to it as a team. So that became quite analytical and almost like a chessboard for me, how I started to see the game. That was the first sort of time I went, Oh shit, it's not babysitting after all, and it's not just guys running around quickly. It's methodical, and it's almost like a game of chess and how we're going to beat the opponent. So Roy was brilliant at that. Mark Hughes, I really enjoyed his management approach because my career really progressed there because his philosophy was all around intensity and work rate and fitness, which really blended my sort of core skills. And his assistant coach, Eddie Nadwetsky, I really teamed up with him. So we basically delivered the majority of the session together. And Eddie was definitely leading that, but he just taught me under his wing. Martin Yole was really important for me as well. He really backed me from a contract perspective. He certainly did that, but he came with a smaller backroom staff. So he was more reliant on me. And he's a smart guy. He saw how close I was with the players because I'd been with this group for some period of time. I had the authority and the discipline with them, but was also close with them. So I had that blend. So he empowered me to deliver a lot more of training as well, which was really good. And then the back end of it was different. It was a really challenging time. I think we had Rene for a couple of, well, it was a short period of time, and then Felix came in. And I've always said you learn something from all the coaches, and that's simple. Some you like, some you don't. But I was respectful enough that this is their time, this is their ship. They get to manage it any way they want. As long as they're respectful and as long as I'm growing, I'll stay at Fulham. So yeah, I saw many coaches come and go, and just waiting at home for the phone call from the boss a few times, going, okay, well, maybe today it will change. But the phone call used to come, it would be at Cannizzaro House instead and meet the new boss, and tell him all about the playing group and get them ready for Saturday. It's like, okay, geez, lasted another one. Let's go again. So that was the first sort of sign, mate, of you're in a cutthroat industry. The minute you move into that assistant coach role where it's quite transient, yeah, it's not relative to performance. It can be a whole lot of things. It's interesting.
Sometimes reflect back on though from the initial phone call to Matt Spare Park there calling Steve to all the way to standing on the touchline facing Diego Simeone's let go Madrid in the Europa League final in 2010.
What a game
Absolutely
it was,
insane.
mate. What a game. I'm glad you touched on that because it actually gives me goosebumps every now and again because it's not something I think about quite a lot. It's one of those ones in the highlight reel, but you've moved on in your life. But just the experience of being in Europe, the police sirens sound different when you're driving to the ground. You know, the noise, the warmth in the air, the chants are different. You get to the stadium, it's not a Premier League stadium, it's different. Suddenly you're playing against a different team. There's a different atmosphere. It's quite surreal. It was my first time in Europe outside of being a pre-season friendly with the atmosphere. And we had some incredible times, like driving down the wrong side of the street with a police escort in Rome to go and play Roma. Just chaos. Felix Magath booking out the best hotel in town and no one staying in it. So we had to stay in like a Holiday Inn with red curtains, which was see-through when we played Wolfsburg. These crazy things that happen. Although it's a glorified world, the experiences of, spending so much time with a group of players. I mean, I think we played 65 games that year total. And geez, we saw our teammates and staff more than our families that year. It was absolutely brilliant, mate.
It's pretty incredible though. You list down the, I would say, the slew of great games and great nights you would have had at Fulham from the Great Escape down at Portsmouth in 2008. You know, the night you beat Juventus in the quarterfinal at Craven Cottage, the Europa League final. I suppose that buzz and that adrenaline never leaves you. How could it once you get once you get used to it once or twice, come like an addict, keep chasing, chasing. Do you find that in your post career? That's something that's lived with you, even though, you know. Hate to surprise people now that you're outside of football. Is that a feeling that you're still chasing?
Yeah, it's funny that I made a conscious choice to actually leave professional football because my environment that I had to be in at the time couldn't support that same level of football, and it never felt the same, mate. You're on a team bus driving into a Premier League stadium, and you just feel the passion, the roar of the crowd. Outside of that, the players you're working with daily are elite players, physically, technically, mentally. They're just of a different level. So they drive your standards as well. And the minute I went back to Australia and those standards started to drop with respect to the people I work with, I made that choice to do that for family purposes and family reasons. So I had to take a hit on the whole standards of quality of operator I was working with. But with respect, you learn something everywhere you go. So it wasn't as if I was chasing it. It was a case of I just had to expect less from the people I was working with because the standards were so high. And that did wane on me, if I'm honest with you. By the end, it was like football was not the same anymore. The longer I do this, the more I'm going to resent the game because I'm going to be looking over there going, I once was working with this guy that could do that passing practice or implement that tactical thing I was talking about. And this isn't working. So, yeah, it was a conscious choice to actually shift my mindset around my expectations and then step away from football for that perspective. Because I know a lot of people that stay in the game far too long and they start to resent it because it's no longer fun. The standards aren't the same. They're getting old, they're getting a bit tired, and they're still coaching for the wrong reasons. And I thought, no, I'm going to get out early and go and chase that next mountain in something that I can reinvent myself with the same profile, same learnings, and do something to the same level. And when we joined my business, I said, said to the founder, I'm not doing this just in Australia. I'm doing the same thing. And if you've got that same vision, let's go and have a crack and let's make this a global company. And he was already up for that. He's got that mentality as well. So same drive and purpose and aggression. You need that aggression, but just in a different segment. So yeah, it's been a good journey.
An unwavering amount of drive and passion. And it comes to mind, I think, of a fellow Australian, Ange Postecoglou. It's a nice way to dovetail into the next talking point. But as you mentioned earlier on, players acting as your CV, the story is how you became Ange's assistant. I don't think it happened in today's world, but it's an equally interesting one all the same. Could you talk us through it?
It was strange. I mean, geez, I'm just trying to I can remember it, but just in terms of the sequence, I mean, you've got two contrasting people. You know, you've got a big hitter and Mark Schwarzer, who was heavily connected with the national team. He was the goalkeeper, but he was coming to the end of his career when Ange took over, and he was heavily connected and respected at the Football Football Federation Australia. So there was an endorsement from Mark Schwarzer at the time that you should consider. Certainly consider Scott, blah, blah, blah. That was one. But then the oddest one, who currently lives down the road from me, about 200 meters down the road, is Georgi Karagounis. And I think it was Martin Jol. Yeah, correct. Martin Jol brought him over. And he just semi-retired from Panathinaikos, but he'd always had this dream to play in the Premier League. And Martin Jol brought him in on trial. But he says, I don't trial. He's like, I don't trial. So we basically created a situation where it was a fitness test. And I did this technical fitness drill with finishing because he loves to score goals. And it was like recovery runs and bam, 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 and put him through his paces. And he was phenomenal. So ever since that day, because Martin Jol basically said, is he worth it? I went, it's George Karagounis. He's an animal. He's a machine. He loves football. He's still passionate. What's not to love? What are you going to lose? So George loved what I did for him and helped him. And then he just basically called Postecoglou out of the blue and said, you take Scotty in his creek, eh? You take him. You take him. So I was sitting having curry in East London on a Friday night with a couple of mates, and this AU number keeps popping up on my phone. And I didn't know who it was, and I'm just delete, didn't you know? And then it was eventually I took it, and it was Ange asking to have a chat about joining him in his coaching staff. So 10 days later on a plane and standing there and working with Ange Postecoglou, who I admire and respect gratefully because he's more than just a coach. He's incredible person and a leader, but such a strong desire and mentality to be brilliant in what he does and take people with him. And that's the difference. I've seen leaders over the time that do everything for them, and they you can smell them a mile away, whereas he takes people and guides people, and that's what he's about, and that's why he's special.
Last May, when he had his success, I don't think even the most ardent Arsenal fan could begrudge him his night, such as the universal love for someone like Ange.
Yeah, for sure.
What lessons have you took from working with him into this new role in the AI world?
Interesting. Well, from him, but more importantly, probably sport. When you know, we've got a young founder in James Doyle, ex-athlete as well. Our ability to stay resilient in challenge when you're starting a business is our strength. But also, when we get a knockback, we look at each other and go, "I'm changing gears." And you've got the ability to change gears and stay focused and drive even more and stay really focused on where and where we want to take the business. So, Ange is certainly, when I align it to him, if you read his backstory and watch all the documentaries on him, I mean, it's unparalleled that and how he became, and he never doubted it, by the way, a Premier League manager. He's been working for that all his life. And it was a proud moment when you see him unveiled as a Tottenham manager, right? And we went there last year and we spent some time with him and Millay and Nick Montgomery and stuff. And to see these guys running a football club at that level is a different level. But I keep coming back to his resilience for some reason, and just never give up, keep pushing, find a way, and be resourceful with time, effort, and resources, and don't see blockers as a challenge and a full stop. Find a way to actually go around them. And I used to have a mentor at Fulham go, "Don't go around them, go over the top of them." So I remember that mentality. It was goes, "Yeah, don't be sneaky around, just go fucking bang right over the top of them." Not in an aggressive, deceitful way, but boom, direct, and make it work. So yeah, all these people have got similar mentalities, mate. They just deliver it in a different message.
It's an interesting one as well, in preparation for this and obviously speaking with Dave a little bit more about your backstory. Someone that's graduated from the very bottom, worked your way to the very top at Fulham. You become the Socceroos assistant with Ange, go across then become the youngest coach in A-League history. To leave it all behind seems a bit incredible, after 20 years. But talk to us about that second peak. You go and summit one mountain, summit one peak, don't like the view. And you're ready to go back down and just begin it all again in another career.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, you know what? As I said to you, it was like, when is enough enough? I mean, what people don't talk about is this. You know, Jose Mourinho, for example, I was a big admirer of his because when I got over there, he was Chelsea. You know, you count how many jobs he's had in the last 10 years, right? Guardiola's had a lot of stability, but you look at his personal life, lack of stability. A lot of these coaches are living in hotels and it's transient lifestyles and it's not easy, right? So, you know, you look at the Premier League games over the weekend and you'd ask yourself, knowing behind the curtain, how many of them are living in hotels or apartment by themselves while their wife and kids are somewhere else in the world? Because of school commitments or not being from England, for example. So I know the realities of that life and how challenging it can be. You know, and the 1 or 2 year deals, 3 year deals, 4 year deals, the reality is it's a performance industry. And to be honest with you, mate, I got to a point where it's like, I've actually, and I spoke to Dave about it, and he actually said, "You've got nothing to prove." And I remember I put the phone down and I made a cup of coffee, and he goes, "He's right." Because the only thing I had something to prove was that geezer back in 2000 and whatever it was, five, that decided to buy a one-way ticket to see if he could crack it in the Premier League. And I superseded that 10x. So what are you going to get on a plane for and accept a salary in Egypt or America? Or for what? To isolate yourself away from your family and friends, disconnect from your parents, start a new life in a new environment for a job. And for me, it was a case of, he's right, I actually don't have anything to prove. And you know, I actually rate a new story and that next mountain we speak about, because I can translate everything I've learned and my network I've learned into that new space, without having to leave my family, leave my parents, and disconnect from family and friends. So that was a big driver for me, reclaiming some life and some identity from a outside of sport perspective. Because I know so many guys in sport, mate, they don't have a life outside sport, and they wonder when they get the sack, they fall apart because there's no foundations under them. They're attaching to a badge so aggressively that they don't actually have any balance to their life, because it just takes over their life. And I learned that. I went, wow. And Newcastle taught me that, mate. When I was sacked from Newcastle, I'd worked 12, 15 years to get to where I was, and then you work for a league in Australia and you get sacked for political reasons. So what are you going to land on? A hard floor or a trampoline of foundation of family and friends and a good network around you and have a bit more control of your life?
Amazing too that shift though, isn't it? Because when hard work becomes a proxy for everything, it's such an identity-based habit to kind of take that time out to begin to reflect and ponder as to what might be on the other side. People don't understand how important, nonetheless, but how difficult of a mindset shift that actually is.
Yeah, for sure. It was. And you know what? It was, even if you just think about your personal brand, you've always been a coach. And then suddenly the day, and it's not as if you can go and if you want to be taken seriously, Guardiola can't have a year off and go and work with PwC and put that on his LinkedIn. Man City to PwC and then go back to Man United the next year. It's not happening, right? So you've got to protect your own sort of brand in terms of who you work with. And that's a storyboard story of your journey as a coach. And then the minute you do tap out and go and do something different for a few years, the likelihood is, well, are you a professional coach or you're a part-time coach? I don't really understand it. So I had to be really cautious around the timing around what that looked like. And I told you before around, retiring officially as a coach at semi-pro level, if that, at my junior club that I pulled my first pair of boots on in under eights. My assistant coach was my best mate growing up and my striking partner at Langmore. I employed him for 5 years. He was my assistant. The under 21s coach was a friend as well. So we built this coaching staff. And that was my final coaching role on field. So it seemed right. Close the loop at the place you started with some crazy stuff in between and certainly higher levels, but who cares? It was brilliant. It was brilliant.
And then obviously closing the loop on that at your childhood club. I mean, what a story. When did a tech or when did a startup idea begin to become, obviously you complete one fever dream there, working in football, being really aware of the Premier League since you were a kid. Obviously, this AI world that you're in right now, it's very new, very, people are still kind of feeling it out. When did that become kind of the next step?
So good, really good question. And it's funny. So I've known a young gentleman, James Doyle, for about eight years now, and very impressive young founder. And we became friends, and he tells a funny story when we're ever in meetings. So he was actually playing for the opponent's team that we're playing. And I remember it was a Saturday afternoon pre-season, about 30 degrees. And I'd seen him play the year before, and he was a decent player. But this day he was on the bench. So I thought, I'm gonna get into him. So, as the players go and warm up past you to go to the corner flag to warm up, I didn't even make eye contact with him. As he walked past, I went, oh my God, you must have dropped off or be absolute dog shit because your team's terrible, right? Something like that. And didn't even look at him. And he just blew up. He saw the red mist, right? He didn't say anything to me, but he was down at the corner flag stretching, just burning because I just left it on him. Like, your team's terrible. And how are you on the bench like this? Jesus, terrible. So our friendship started from me mugging him off, to the point where he came to me with an idea, and it was bad timing for me personally at that time. So he agreed to go and do a bit more research and get some sort of POC sort of built up from, a certain level. And he came back to me about 8 months later and we played two games of golf, and it was like a serenade dance. It was hilarious. We were just basically like on the golf course playing golf, but it was like all dancing around. He was trying to pull me in, and I was, that cautiousness of departing the football world. I wasn't really quite ready, and I must have sat on the decision for about 6 weeks. And I actually was a bit of a toe dipper. I said to him at first, I said, okay, let's keep this on the lowdown. I'll sort of consult for two days a week and support it, and we'll do it that way to begin with, because at least you're protecting your investment in terms of time, effort, and resources to me, and I'll get an idea if this is comfortable for me. So we did that, and that was him and I in a small office in Collins Street. To the point now, we've got about 25 staff across Australia and Belfast, and we look at each other on a Friday afternoon having a pint, going, "What? How do we do this?" But it comes down to our mentality of we're driven, we're driven. And we call it a high performance team. We take care with recruitment. We bring the right people in. We try and make the right decisions to make their environment right for them as well. We've got the pool table. We've got the table tennis table. We've got the food and the bars, and we've got everything. We look after them just like a normal team. So that's our aim. That's our aim.
Seems as though, I mean, through 20 years in the footballing industry, 18 months in a tech startup world, there's an awful lot of similarities. In addition to all the skills you currently have, another big one of yours is storytelling or story writing on LinkedIn. And I was just reading one of the articles that you published last night before bed, and it was interesting. You had three core tenets as to how similar the football and tech worlds are, and I'd love to go a bit more deeper into it. Number one, feedback beats perfection. Two, clear roles build trust. And three, and most importantly, culture scales, ego doesn't. So it'd be interesting to hear you verse a bit more about that.
That's all sort of learned. It was really interesting, right? So, I've been fortunate enough to have some incredible mentors that have actually provided me so much feedback, right? So, and we try and work on that as much as possible at iReal as well in terms of the feedback around what we're doing and little check-ins around the growth strategy. So, yes, giving people autonomy to do things, but I just remember as a coach, you know, either as a young player, when the coach comes up to you and you haven't asked for feedback, you're buzzing. You're like, wow. And it could just be something really small. But he's like, you know, people you look up to, i.e. coach, you admire, comes away and goes, I love what you did with your little flick around the corner there. And you're like, I didn't even realize I did it, but you saw it. So they validate that. So they build that confidence piece. So the feedback is really important. In terms of, I've been in incredible environments where you can feel ego. And it's an odd one. I'm strange. We talk about, you know, arrogance with ignorance and ignorance with arrogance and the balance between the two. Some of the best players I worked with at Fulham were the least arrogant and most modest because they knew how good they were. They knew they were on the team sheet. They knew they could produce because they believed in themselves. You know, and the tech startup world is obviously difficult because you're building a product and you're basically a race against time to beat competition to it. And there's pressure. So you've got to deal with that pressure. And when things aren't delivered, it's very easy, as you're aware, being in sport, that, you know, the blame game when things aren't in on time or things aren't executed, people can, you know, detach. But we're very big on, right, this is a big team. Product and commercial are connected, operations connected, and we all drive each other through our processes internally. Because when we get the product out there to a partner, everyone's lifted on that. And I've never forgotten that from a team.
Must be such an interesting kind of career arc for yourself, you know, going into Fulham or originally working in a highly, I would say, individualized and specific skilled role such as a fitness coach, having to work more globally within that structure. Whereas now you're in that position of manager, you know, and you're helping all the technical specialists below. It's an interesting pivot, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know what? It's so aligned. So, you know, you go back to the fitness coach where, you know, you've got your five key disciplines across fitness, nutrition, S&C, blah, 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 blah. On they go. My skill set was because I could do the on-field stuff as well as the off-field stuff. So you saw players in different environments. I learned how to influence, let's use that word, Danny Murphy to do leg weights and upper body weights, and he never wanted to lift a weight in his life. He influenced Simon Davies to do upper body weights, and he's like, I don't need to because I've got massive legs. So the ability to actually improve communication was really important. And there's no different in a tech startup. It's about giving people the time to learn, giving them the process to deliver, and giving them sort of targets to actually hit that aren't driven by fear, but driven by outcomes that improve their confidence. And that's really important to understand the difference of setting performance targets for staff. Not everyone can deal with pressure. It's all about, right, set outcomes to drive the product forward and celebrate when it is moved forward and make sure the right people get credit for it. And generally, that should be the entire team. So, yeah, it's a unique blend. We've got people, as I said, in Belfast and Australia and a couple sitting in the Mediterranean and Aalborg and the likes. And we like to connect every couple of months in person in Belfast. But it's no different to being a head coach. And I'm not a head coach in this role. I'm sort of underneath James as he's the founder. But, you know, with my experience in sport, being that assistant coach, I'll leave this one with you. It feels no different. It feels like I'm the assistant coach to the head coach again. Having done that job, managed 40 staff at Newcastle with a big budget. So one, I can be an asset to him as a young founder, not only to him individually, but also the team, because I'm used to dealing and managing with big groups of people. So that can allow him to look up and out. So it's a unique blend. And how we found each other was that day on that pitch when I mugged him off.
It's an amazing story. And it's interesting when we bring it back all to football. I mean, where do you see AI? I mean, I feel there's an awful lot of misconceptions, or I feel it hasn't been as articulated well about the possible impacts it could have in the football or the wider sports and industry. Where do you think it has most value or maximum impact for disruption, Scott?
Yeah, good question. Good question. And, you know, it's interesting. There is a lot of fear out there, but I think that's a case of people not really understanding its power. So, Our product that we've built, or our business that we've built, is generative AI. So imagine source data, imagine Liverpool's GPS data from training. Imagine a layer on top of that allows you to speak to it. So the ability for a match analysis, a fitness coach to actually query it through Q&A or voice to text and actually get insights quicker. So we're not here to replace the human. We're actually there to support the human to drive efficiencies, identify insights quicker that actually support the strategic decision for the clubs, organizations, for example. So, I think, you read the paper or the internet. No one reads a paper anymore, do they? Not necessarily. But the reality is there's a lot of industries that will be impacted by AI. But from a coach's perspective, we've just spent an hour talking about intuition, resilience, mentality, communication, understanding people. The reality is, if I can have more time with the individual as opposed to downloading GPS data, interpreting it, putting a report together to give to the manager, I'm going to have more of an influence. So I think data's always been here, and generative AI is just another level of intelligence that brings insights to the fore quicker. We've been looking at data and Excel spreadsheets all my life in sport. And I wish I had this form of technology now, because the amount of time spent on looking at GPS data or scout reports, trying to get them to talk to each other, whereas now the ability to actually blend in different data sources and ask one question of it, it can give me some response because we've trained the model to do so. You can imagine the power for practitioners, which is important. It's not telling them what to do, it's basically guiding them around their own knowledge bank that they can actually empower the model to support them with.
Amazing though. It sounds as though, again, all of this can be trained as a skill set, being very much open-minded. And if we speak about AI in a wider circumstance, it seems as those that are most willing to adapt and evolve and take feedback and iterate upon it quickly are the ones that are most likely to succeed. So it is an interesting dance amongst that. And I think you put it best recently on LinkedIn too, when you said, people stop asking. It's not coach versus AI, it's coach plus AI.
Spot on, spot on. That's my view. It's coach plus AI. So it's a coach being able to actually utilize AI as a tool to leverage the data that's already collected. And you can utilize any word right now that can improve that individual, whether it be efficiency, whether it be insights, whether it be strategic decisions. But I've been that case study, been up all night trying to recruit a team at Newcastle, looking at Instat data and creating profit and loss Excel spreadsheets to see how, if I sign this player, what would increase in forward third entries and key passes would it make? And I did all that manually through Excel, right? And I could just imagine having something where I could dump this data in a private, secure manner, and then overlay it and ask it questions. I wouldn't have been up all night trying to identify what team to sign for Newcastle, and then build out reports. I could go to the board and say, this is why we have to pay this player a little bit more, because you can add out value 25% in chances and front third creation if we sign him based around the benchmarks of the league, for example. So seeing data differently and bringing it to light quicker leads us less manual work for us. There's less manual work. We're not all analytics and sitting in the background. We're front facing as coaches. So, and I know we're talking in general, but coaches are front facing, influencing individuals. You need to be with individuals, and the more information you've got to support them, how much better is that?
Seems as though speaking to you, you're so energized, you've repurposed an awful lot of that drive and passion that's fueled your progress from the very, from your very beginnings in rural Australia all the way to the top of the Premier League and where you are now. But someone, as you said earlier on, as someone who yourself prides yourself on setting these big, lofty, audacious goals, Scott, what does success look like for you in these next 5 to 10 years?
I keep saying good question, and Dave said you ask good questions, but I keep saying it. Yeah, it's not, I'm not buying time. I'm just actually thinking out loud. Listen, do you know what? I'm going to answer that this like this. For a long time, I always defined it and was always looking for the next thing, right? I'm going to be generous to myself now. And what success looks like is if we've been able to simply build a group of core group of people, i.e., like we've done now, put something out to the world that people enjoy and like, and it drives efficiency in sport for one, for the practitioners, because we did it the hard way. The likes of Dave and I did it the hard way, collecting data manually on clipboards and all this type of stuff, and then having to input it into computers. But from a personal standpoint, enjoy the ride. There were so many years at Fulham. I was, when's my next contract? When am I, next game, next win, next win, next win. And it becomes tiring. So at this point, although we're all driven, I'm actually enjoying the process of building a business with some really cool people. And the outcome will be based around our energy and our knowledge that we put into it and our effort. But I'm not forecasting too far ahead. I'm just enjoying it because I spent the last 20 years forecasting and working and driving and driving. Sometimes you miss out on so much. So that's my vision for the present time.
What a process. I mean, Scott Miller, what an absolute fascinating story. I was delighted we could actually get on today and record. But before we wrap it up, for anyone that's slightly bit inspired by that journey that we've spoke of for the last 50 or so minutes, on the other end of the table now, if someone was to buy you that big that big cup of soup in Starbucks, what would be the one bit of key advice you'd have for them?
You know what? I've done that numerous times over the last 10 years, and even still do it. And I actually got a handwritten letter 6 months ago. It got delivered. I don't know how they got my address, but it was someone that did the same thing, and they got my address through a network, and they wrote me a hand letter, and they actually said, "Thank you for giving me the courage to go and do it." That was fascinating, because I was like, you don't even really, you're just in your own little world. You don't really like realize people are watching, and you just do it. But simply the advice would be this. Make that call, buy the biggest cup of coffee with the best person you can get in contact with, and ask unbelievable questions. But most importantly, don't attach to an outcome that you're going to get anything straight away. And because I believe it's all about timing, it's all about the right person, and generally it comes down to your personality. And I love energy, so the reality is energy is really important in an environment. So back yourself, trust yourself, but make that phone call. Don't wait for it. Don't wait for that job on LinkedIn, that perfect job. Get out there and call people. Don't hide behind an email. I'd be getting their phone numbers if I can and call them and ask to meet them. That's the key, because your personality speaks volumes. That's my view.
Scott Miller, what an inspiration. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Mate, great to connect with you, and lovely to meet you, mate. I appreciate your questions are off the chain. Love them.